välkommen, as we say in Swedish. This is Red Ice Radio. I'm Henrik Palmgren. Thank you for joining us today. Our website is redicecreations.com. Radio, news, videos and more. Check out our latest insight video if you haven't already, called Saint George and the White Whore, for the latest of wonders of what the masses are being programmed with on television. It's up on the front page right now. Don't miss it. We also have redicemembers.com for our supporters and subscribers, those of you who want our full archive. And then we have redicesradio.net that takes you right to our free radio archive. We have Jason Erb back on the program today. He is in Waterloo, Canada. His website is faux-capitalist.com, which he started during the global financial collapse in 2008. We have, as we did last time, a number of important topics lined up today. We're going to begin on the Ottawa shooting, false flag terrorism in Canada, and the increasing tensions between Muslims, Jews, and Christians, as Stephen Harper's turned Canada into a staunch Israel supporter in recent years. We'll also discuss the threats to free speech and freedom of the press in Canada, as Arthur Topham, who we recently had on the program, has experienced. Stay with us as we continue to examine Canada. Hey, Jason, welcome back. It's good to have you on the program once again. Hope you're doing well today.
Yes, thanks, Henrik.
Excellent. Now, you've been keeping up the good work over at faux-capitalist.com, and there certainly isn't a lack of issues to address here, but I thought we could begin with the Ottawa shooting and talk a little bit more about that. It's actually, well, we're a bit late to this party, I guess. I wish I would have picked up on it sooner, but I guess the dust have settled to a certain extent, and now the government, of course, have fully put in place their campaign to use the event for their own purposes, legitimizing not only more control and surveillance and anti-terrorism laws and the rest. I think it's going to make the Canadian people suffer more as usual as these kind of events go. But there's a lot of agendas behind it and a lot of things going at once here. Not the least to say the increased tension, I'd say, between Canadians and Muslims. I mean, on one hand, they tell us that we can't be Islamophobic, you know, by golly, no way. But then at the same time, they use the media to kind of hype up these events and really scare us into submission at the same time. And I think it creates more support for, you know, the war in the Middle East and of course, letting Canada get even more joined in on the new crusade for Israel and letting the West deal with the conflict in the Middle East. So there's, in my view, a lot of things kind of running at the backdrop of all of this. But what's been your assessment of the Ottawa shooting and how the government has been seeking to use this event?
Well, the whole issue was really upsetting for me because what I had seen is that since September 11th, 2001, that apart from some initial dislocations, as far as that the U.S. government told the Canadian government that you better do what we say you have to do with border controls, otherwise we're going to completely lock up all the traffic going across the border, especially by car. Of course, meanwhile, the U.S.-Mexico border is still in certain areas completely wide open. So we know that wasn't really about preventing against terrorists just coming across in weak points in that. But the thing that happened was that I'd say over the past 6 and even 8 years especially, that there had been a huge drifting away in terms of the mindset of the American people versus the Canadian people, that really the Canadians, like myself, did not really feel touched by this whole war on terror, that you had the Afghanistan mission then was the only thing that we had been involved in up until they got us involved in sending some of our planes to be involved with the Libya airstrike. But again, with that being an airborne operation, that people, Canadians, didn't really feel too much part of it. And then it was portrayed as it wasn't a United Nations thing, that was vetoed by China and Russia, but it was a NATO thing that was conducted in that case. And Canada's a big supporter of NATO, a big choir boy, especially when you have the conservative government in power here. And the thing is that really the Canadians didn't feel too much a part of the whole war on terror in that case, that you could just read a couple articles and it was such a small contingent that really the planes that had their day, the CF-18s had their day back during the Gulf War of 1991. And so along with other things as well, that we didn't have the equivalent of the Patriot Act in Canada. And of course, because we weren't directly attacked on that day. And to me, what really crushed me was that I saw this whole shooting incident and the way it was being used is that the decision, I think, had been made that the Canadians had gotten too used to being apart from the American mindset that had been drummed in with all the other events, too, that had taken place in the United States. And, of course, the Iraq War being a big thing. But that whether it was planned or they took advantage of it, that they definitely did that, the latter of saying that, you know, that this is can't be the case anymore, that Canadians can actually return to the kind of freedoms that the Americans had pre-9/11. We got to close this gap here because along with increasing economic integration, we just can't have the Canadians just be so different in their mindset of not fearing different entities out there.
Yeah.
And so that was a big crushing thing for me because I had feared that at least in the follow-up with this, that our government had been completely hijacked by the same people who've been pulling off the things since 9/11 of ramming through the Patriot Act and getting rid of the Posse Comitatus so that the military could be involved in the civilian operations. And you don't have those kind of things in Canada. And so they needed some justification then to close the gap between the two countries. And so, that was really the big thing as I had seen it. And you compare it to, there was actually an incident of terrorism in Canada that took place on the land. And that was in the 60s and right in 1970 with the FLQ crisis, which was, it was a true terrorist thing of there was a group in Quebec where they wanted to separate from Canada and they wanted a Marxist country there and to separate. And so they actually had bombings that took place over several years and they conducted what it ultimately culminated in. There was a kidnapping of a British diplomat and one of the ministers of the government. And that's when the prime minister at the time, Pierre Trudeau, who many people would know, that he invoked the War Measures Act, which had only been used during wartime. And they promised that they would go and put back those powers once the problem had been dealt with. And then quickly after that, they were managed to crush that whole movement. And you never had any kind of violent terrorism like that take place again. But that was a whole Canadian organic thing. You could see how there could be a group that would figure that violence was the best way to deal with such a situation in order to pull out of the country, because the way that the votes are rigged in that it's really, it's very difficult to do that, as we saw with what happened in Scotland, for instance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So this whole event here, that it really concerned me that this was some complete foreign hijacking then of our interests as Canadians that had taken place, and that the people in charge and the ones controlling them, that they don't have any interest whatsoever in returning to a state of normalcy after invoking extraordinary powers, that they plan on normalizing this situation and furthering it as well, taking us closer to the kind of police state mentality and actual laws that exist in the United States.
Yep, exactly. The same problem there. And despite that, I mean, even despite that, I think Canada has been very supportive with troops on the war on terror nonetheless, right? They've been right there with America, and yet it doesn't seem to be enough, right? It's kind of been going cold a little bit. So it's very convenient, if nothing else, that it kind of heats up again. But tell us more about the nature of the shooting here then, because it's strange. I've heard a lot of people talking about the usual stuff, obviously, of no security whatsoever at Parliament Hill. Was there no security there? Was that really true? They could just, he could walk right in, basically. And of course, we do have the usual rumors about drills being run in the same day, very close in the area. So, what's your take on that?
Right. So it was shocking to me, and I had read from other Canadians as well who were shocked that you actually had supposedly no kind of armed security guards or police near the entrance of the parliament, especially after the guy had shot a soldier near the war memorial, and it would take him a little bit of time then to get that car and drive up to the front of it. And even the case of that there was some guard supposedly sitting in a chair near the entrance, and that he got shot at by the shooter, but then he supposedly returned some shots then at the shooter, but there was no sort of the guy wasn't taken down, and then he was able to go all the way down a hall. And what was so shocking about it, in addition to this, was that supposedly the prime minister was actually hiding in a closet during one of the cabinet, not just cabinet, the caucus meeting. So all the members of the governing party at the time, who have a majority in parliament and can pretty much pass whatever the heck that they want. Otherwise, they get kicked out of the party. And so, you know, that's the question right there, is that it's public knowledge in terms of when they have these gatherings, but that was quite the thing in terms of, like, in that case, that was pretty shrewd terrorism and of going and having that sort of thing. But it seems to me that, like, it really goes and benefits the whole military-industrial complex, and also the kind of interests that were behind the Iraq War, which has served very well Israel's interest specifically, of going into having a weakened Middle East, the neighbors around them, and also that bringing Canada in the same boat then as Israel to an extent of that, well, we have this global war on terrorism that we have to fight against the Islamists. And it was very revealing that, for instance, that the prime minister had received a call from the Israeli prime minister before he had even spoken to the Canadian people. And this is where it was actually delayed at least twice beyond the time that he was originally supposed to speak to Canadians, but he found the time to speak with Israel's prime minister. And then as far as the shooting goes and how it followed up afterwards, that the guy who took down the shooter was the sergeant at arms, who traditionally just carries the ceremonial mace, although that actually, in the course of the parliamentary history, I'm not sure about Canada specifically, but in the British parliament, it actually was used at times to bring order into the parliament by swinging the mace around, but it's just been totally ceremonial now. But the whole thing is that they're saying that the sergeant at arms, that he was the guy, finally, he heard there was a ruckus going on. He got out of his office. He pulled the gun then that I think he had in his desk, and he went and took down the shooter while the shooter was so close, they're saying, to this gathering that was taking place of the whole governing party caucus while the prime minister was hiding in the closet. And another important thing is that the head of the security for the parliament actually is the sergeant at arms. So as far as this goes, that you would definitely wonder about the security about it. But since this guy's the big hero now, it's very politically difficult to go and criticize him for the kind of job that he did in ensuring the security of that whole area. And then following up with the Israeli connection is that this is the big news in the past week, was that not only was the sergeant at arms that he scheduled and he attended a security conference in Israel, but he was also brought before the Israeli parliament, and he was given a hero's welcome there.
Really?
Yes. Huh. And again, this leads back to my initial concerns before so many of the details started coming out here about how this is being used then to go and bring us more in league with the United States and with Israel's interests as well.
Well, you know, precisely, that's just it. I know that the Harper government has been very, very keen on this type of cooperation, but, you know, just to give our audience a little bit more here in terms of what was talked about on CBC shortly afterwards, describing the scenario that took place. I think it was Adrian Arzenau from CBC basically discussing National Security Task Force drills being conducted in the days and then actually weeks leading up to the attack in Ottawa. And she said they, meaning the Canadian authorities, may have been surprised by the actual incidents, but not by the concepts of them. Within the last few months, we know that the CSIS and the RCMP and the National Security Task Force ran a scenario that's akin to a war games exercise if you will, where they actually imagine literally an attack in Quebec, followed by an attack in another city, followed by a tip that that hey, some foreign fighters are coming back from Syria. It's kind of a little convoluted here, but there's a clip of this. She goes on to say, so they were imagining a worst case scenario. They were they're seeking elements of that happening right now. Canadian authorities may talk today in terms of being surprised, but we know that this precise scenario has been keeping them up at night for a while. So obviously they knew about this. So what have you been able to tell about the perpetrator here, Michael Sahaf Bibu, if that's how you pronounce his name? What do you know about him?
So his mother is Canadian, and that his father is was from Libya. And so therefore you have the ethnic connection there to the Middle East, at least half of it. And that he had only recently become a Muslim. And so it wasn't the case that he was born that way. And so the kind of thing here, what I really stood out to me in that case, and also you mentioned the guy, the soldier being run down, that actually took place 2 days earlier. And this is what originally got me thinking about what was taking place here. Was that in both cases you have then some Canadian-born people who then became Muslim later on. So that whole angle is covered there in terms of that it's not just a case of we got to halt all Muslim immigration, as there are some people calling for, specifically maybe some people writing for Canada's national newspaper, one of them the National Post and that Sun News Network. Because constantly they're going and saying about there's this big problem with Islamism and Islamists in Canada. But then again, some of these people writing for these big newspapers and the television station, they have connections with the people who are going and influencing and running government. So mm-hmm. if they really wanted to stop and have selective immigration, they could really do that over the course of a few years by propagandizing people the way that they wanted to through the media.
Right.
And so they would have that ability to go and put in these sort of restrictions, all in the name of security, of course. But so that's the thing, is that the whole idea anyway is put out there that, well, yeah, that anyone could become Muslim, and then there's the possibility that they could be radicalized. So then it stops that whole, so much of the criticism just blunts it in terms of we got to restrict all Muslim immigration, or we got to look more carefully into the immigrants. Now it becomes like we got to look domestically at who be radicalized. And of course, now the group is that, well, we got to look at radicalized Muslims, but you look to a terrorist attack that took place over the ocean, and it was a group of Sikhs, extremists who were living in Canada. They were Canadian citizens, and they went and blew up a plane. It was actually the largest air act of terrorism that there had been prior to 9/11, of nearly like 300 people that were killed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so again, that's like a thing of there's other cases besides just the Muslim extremism in Canada. And so now later it could be the case of, well, yeah, we originally had to go after the Muslims, but now we have to go after the Sikhs because they went and did this thing back then. And then we have to go after these other groups. There's the Christian extremist groups as well. So to me, that was a very significant thing, you asking about these two individuals and that they said were behind the attacks. And the whole problem is that with the shooters dying, or in the case of the guy who also ran over the soldier, with these guys not alive right now, you don't really know. You can't go and cross-examine the witnesses as well.
That's right. They take him out, and anything could be constructed in hindsight, or even, you know, piecing together evidence of their life, or who, you know, how they got there and whatnot. But what do you think is going to do in terms of the tension that's kind of mounting, the multicultural tension, if you will, in Canada and in all other countries around, you know, in the Western world as well, that we have, you know, to people who just look at the media, if they were to believe everything they read in the media, it's a legitimate threat, right? That's how it's being portrayed in the media. And then at the same time, if we look behind the headlines, we realize that it's usually manipulated. There might be false flag attacks. There might be individuals that we really don't know the allegiances of or who they're working for, or even if they themselves ultimately know who they're working for or who they're taking money from. That kind of stuff is going on as well. But to me, it feels like it's really hardening those types of tensions. And it's also creating, you know, this kind of schism in people's heads that they say, well, you know, you can't be Islamophobic, right? Or you can't be, you have to tolerate everybody. And then at the same time, the media really heightens the fear around, you know, Muslims, for example. So that's creating a tremendous tension, in my view, in a way. What do you make of that, Jason?
Yeah, it's creating big divisions then within the society, because there are those Canadians who sincerely believe that there should be Muslims in Canada. Of course, you run into that little issue of it being a religion. And even though there's like the whole political and then potentially the military aspect to it as well, but only in the context of a state, is that anyone, any Canadian, could become a Muslim. And especially in the case of these two guys then that they said carried out these attacks, that any Muslim. So even though there's those people who sincerely say we got to ban all immigration from the Muslim countries, that you would still have this issue then if this was indeed a case of organic terrorism or whether it was set up in any particular case. But then there's the other aspect of that I don't see it happening in terms of it being allowed that we're going to go and ban all immigration from any particular group, because that runs into a huge issue of that Canada is the country that least opposes the mass immigration of people from all around the world, despite being a European country in its laws, institutions, culture, and heritage.
Yeah, that's right.
And the whole thing is that I was just thinking about this earlier today, is that you would have, as I mentioned, like the National Post and the Sun media organization, which, by the way, that just happened to have a bunch of people at the top who were avowed Zionists. But
interesting. Isn't that always the case, though, when you do get kind of critiqued, that they make sure to funnel it in the right direction, you know?
Yeah, the particular thought I had was about how, like, they're saying, like, we really got to limit the immigration from Muslim countries, and or we need to have, like, really tough screening, and we got to change our laws to really crack down. But that's all for show in terms of that, even because of the mindset that has been put into the Canadian mind, that they wouldn't even think of restricting immigration of one particular group overall. And of course, this goes back to the agenda that perhaps we'll want to talk about later, about going and undermining the character of this country, of the ideals then and the people who founded it. But yeah, that's where it's just, I see it as appealing to those people to lead them down the false trail of false hope, for one, that they would actually get what they want, and that, oh, the big is Muslims, so we got to ban them coming here. Of course, left out of the discussion so much in these forums is about why there may be like a big backlash against what the West, quote unquote, is doing. And it is more than just about Canada. Of course, with the Muslims, about with at least the ones who really adhere to the fundamentals, about it being that an attack against one Muslim is an attack against all Muslims.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And of course, there's like different ways of responding about it, and then there's disagreements here and there. But the big issue there is that it doesn't even just take Canada itself going and doing something, but if it's any Western country, any Zionist country, that therefore it's like an attack against all Muslims. And even though there was that specific thing, I think it was very unfortunate then that Canada got involved with these airstrikes against ISIS, because there was the warning beforehand saying that if you go and take part in these airstrikes, we're going to go and attack you. And again, that was another thing about the interesting timing of it all, like you were talking about with the drills that were taking place beforehand, the things that they were supposedly concerned about, but not concerned enough to actually go and ramp up the security in that area.
No.
That's the thing. Like, you look at 9/11 after that, and it's like the Bush administration, they all go on Cipro to deal with the anthrax, and then like a month later, the anthrax attacks occurred. Like, you think at least if they were considering that they were up at night, they could hardly sleep, yet they didn't even get some guards out front of the parliament. I find that hard to believe.
Yeah. Well, exactly, you know, and so the on one hand, then the airstrikes are you know, Canada takes part of that. They're you know, taking part of all these actions and whatnot, and then at the same time, you have the interests of Canada not being the true interests of the people anymore. And this is something I'd say that's true in almost every Western country in the world right now, that it's the people that get to suffer from the policies that are made by governments that don't have our best interest at heart. And in some cases, it's flat out, as in the cases of America, that it's, you know, a foreign policy very much controlled by Israel. And now the people are having to take the flak for that. And then the Arab world, to a certain extent, I mean, sure, they know about the influences and the shenanigans, I'd say, of Israel. But nonetheless, there's another element there where they solely are trying to pin those responsibilities on the West, and they are taking the blame for it. So it's really dividing the West and the Arab world. And to me, it feels like we have a third party in that picture that's very much enjoying that the conflict takes place on that level, and that the eyes are no longer on them, you know?
Yeah, what I see is that what had especially taken place since with 9/11 was that this whole civilizational struggle, that you have some of the people on the right who actually really believe that this is what the West needs to be involved in, is a civilizational struggle against Islam specifically.
Yeah.
But what that does is, like, I just look to Canada's history, and I just think that being completely alien to the Canadian interests, historically speaking, and even currently, that when you look to World War One and World War Two, and especially with World War One, that how did that whole thing happen, right? But
yeah,
and then because of that happening, that ended up leading to World War Two. But we don't get the true history about either case. But you look with World War One, World War Two, that basically, despite supposedly having independence, we didn't get our own constitution repatriated until 1982, but still we have the Queen as our head of state, so we're still not fully independent. And but the thing is, the World War One and World War Two, that was going into being loyal British dominionists, you could call it, or at least Commonwealthers, of going and fighting their war for them. But in this case, that where did it come in that we're supposed to be involved in a civilizational struggle with Islam to help out Israel? Because you can, at least I can see certainly how it's very beneficial for Israel to be involved in a civilizational struggle against their local enemies, because otherwise that they'll have to go and fight them by themselves. And they know that they can't go and do that, even with the kind of military that they have. Of course, they're already going and receiving $3 billion a year in military assistance from the United States taxpayers.
Yeah.
And actually, I read the good news recently that a poll showed that the majority of Americans are now against that.
It feels like the tide is turning there a little bit, specifically with the latest, war on the Palestinians. I think a lot of people have been looking at it differently. And at the same time, then you are correct. Many people on the right, they don't see the false flag aspects of these types of scenarios, how it's being used against them. They, despite everything, they stand with Israel. You know, they think that this represents, you know, civilization and the West to a certain extent, but not realizing that they're being played and manipulated. So that's a huge problem here, you know?
Right. Because you look at the religious aspect then, and most Zionists are Christian just based upon the numbers. You look, nearly all the evangelical Christians are Zionists, and I think that the number of evangelical Christians is over 30 million. At least that's what one of the disgraced leaders there, Ted Haggard, of some evangelical organization leading, I think, over 30 million of them, that was the figure then of the group of evangelicals that he was leading over there. But what I see in their case is that they view it as a religious struggle in that case. But again, like I also see that not going and fitting in historically with the United States interests. You can just point to the quotes about George Washington, about how the U.S. should have no. Well, actually, there were different quotes by some of the top presidents, so I don't want to misattribute it in his case. But I remember the one quote by one of them about saying that about how we have like that we would have like trading relations with all, and that, but we're not going to make permanent alliances with any particular country, But what you have is, in this case, especially since 9/11, is there's been a permanent alliance made in the United States with Israel. And one thing that I really like to point out in Canada is that you have had the Canadian government, against the wishes of the majority of the Canadian population, enter into an alliance with Israel as well. And actually, that Stephen Harper, the Prime Minister of Canada, the head of our government, is far more pro-Zionist than the head of the United States government, Barack Obama, because really it is a religious issue for the Christian Zionist Prime Minister of Canada that all the talking points that are put out there about how Israel is supposedly the only democracy in the Middle East and they're the only ones who care about human rights. Try telling that then to all the evangelicals that if they would go over there, they'd be sent to jail if they tried preaching the gospel to Jews in Israel.
Yeah.
And also, what about the Christians that are in Israel living there? The excuse was that, they would actually prefer to be citizens of Israel rather than living in the West Bank. But yeah, the West Bank is occupied territory, of course. Perhaps I would also want to be a Arab citizen of Israel rather than living in the occupied territory. But I think that they would have a different view than if Israel got out of there and wasn't terrorizing them. Of course, you have like the nasty terrorists on the side of the Islamic organizations as well that are really just stirring up trouble and doing a disservice to the people as well, beyond just being freedom fighters. But you actually have this major shift then in Canadian policy since 2006, when the Harper government first got in with, they had a couple of minority governments there, and then they finally had their majority, and they're up for election next year. But there was this big shift whereby Canada and the United Nations, that we would go along with every other country except for the United States and Israel, that the United States has served as Israel's proxy vote in the 15-member Security Council. So anytime that Israel wants them to go and put the veto out there, that's what the United States will do for them. Because in my view, that the United States and Israel are controlled by the same entity. I find this whole false paradigm put out there just to get people arguing and divided as to whether the United States controls Israel or Israel controls the United States. I think it's the same group controlling both countries. And they will allow certain things to take place that may seem against the interests of Israel, because there is like a group higher up in the countries and above them as well, beyond just what the majority of the Israeli really hardcore Zionists might want. But there was this shift of that you would have only the United States and Israel in the General Assembly where it's non-binding, but would go and vote against some measure where even Britain and France having the most number of Jews of any European country, and most of them happen to be Zionists. There are some very, I'd say, courageous anti-Zionists in France as well, well as in the United States and around the world who have been speaking out. I know you had Morris on your show recently, and he goes and speaks out against the Zionists as well. And you have Stephen Lenman, who's also a good voice in that regard. But you had Canada suddenly joining in with Israel and the United States in the General Assembly because we lost our seat in the Security Council and we haven't been interested in getting it. But we suddenly started voting along with Israel in these lines. And of course, in the United States, I point to, it's just the influence of the Zionist lobby is just so heavy. But it's like an alien thing here in Canada. There is not this Christian evangelical, like religious vigor then that would even support Israel. You just don't have that. In fact, I would like to point to the courageous actions of the United Church, which is the largest Christian denomination in Canada, that actually called for a boycott of Israeli products.
Speaking to some of the earlier points you brought up as well, Christians are treated horribly in Israel. We've linked to a couple of videos demonstrating this, and it's just incredible that so many Christians are accepting that and not realizing, you know, how they're being used. But, you know, I've said this before, if there wasn't a real threat from extremist Muslims and whatnot, then the behavior of the West, or in particular with who they align themselves with and doing the work for, then it's definitely going to become an issue in the years ahead. And I think Canada sounds very much like Sweden in that capacity. They say yes to everyone. They say they want to be inclusive. They want to be you know, they want to support. Sweden is a little bit more anti-Israeli, though. That's true. We have a very, you know, left-leaning oriented government, and therefore you get a staunch anti-Israeli core group within there. But nonetheless, they're still very, you know, protective of everybody. They want to be inclusive of everybody. And this, of course, eventually you're going to end up with conflicting interests, and the country itself is going to become the battleground of other people who are, you know, we've kind of seen this. The battle of the Middle East is taken upon, you know, foreign soil pretty much. We've had our own bombings in Stockholm. That was back in 2010, for example. So this is something that's going to spread and continue to get worse and worse unless we internally for the country itself makes a decision and says, you know, either this or that, or we have to, I think primarily, Jason, we have to start looking after our own interests first before we try to, you know, appeal to everyone else. I don't know what you think about that.
Yes, and especially in the case of Canada, that Canada doesn't have this big history of being pro-Israel to the extent that the United States has been, that you still don't have the Canadian government going and recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. There's actually one prime minister who got into a bit of trouble for talking about Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. Of course, it is Tel Aviv. And the thing is that, really, again, the religious difference, that you don't have the kind of evangelism that you have in the United States among Christians, and there's more a moderate approach in that regard. So Canada turned its back then on more of the neutral broker, like a country that really could be a lot more neutral than the United States. The United States, I see, is not neutral whatsoever in terms of dealing with the Israelis and the Palestinians. But it said they're the indispensable country to go and have some sort of brokerage of peace terms and ceasefire terms and whatever else between the Israelis and Palestinians, because they just happen to be the most powerful country on the face of the earth that can project their power enough and supposedly has the enough of an authority to carry it out. Because you look to who else could do it? Could China or Russia do it? Then, like, people would say, well, comparatively, no. But you have this big issue with the Zionist lobby in the United States. You just look to different instances about how the over 20, I think it was, standing ovations for Benjamin Netanyahu when he spoke to Congress. It was unparalleled, at least for any sort of recent, you know, perhaps until like George Washington got up there to give a speech, or one of the early presidents, the number of standing ovations that were given, at least for a foreign leader, was totally unprecedented. Whereas, like I was saying, in Canada, you had the United Church, then the biggest Christian denomination, calling for a boycott then of Israeli products. And that was really fought so hard in the media here. Mm-hmm. And all kind of arguments, well, you know, why are they worrying about this when they could be worrying about like helping poor people and things like that?
Right. Well, exactly. You know, what effects do you think we're going to see from this now then with Harper's stance here and the politics of Canada taking a turn kind of in this direction a little bit? Because there's been a number of very high profile free speech cases in Canada. Famously, we have the Ernst Zundel trial that was, when was that? Back in the 80s sometimes, late 80s or something.
Yeah, originally, yes. Yeah.
And then we've had more recently cases like Arthur Topham, but there certainly isn't a lack of them. They've been coming one after the other. It seems to be a real problem with the diminishing free speech and freedom of the press in Canada. How do you view this?
Yeah, and that's a parallel aspect here as well, that you mentioned about Ernst Zundel. And the thing there was that in our criminal code, there was a provision that you couldn't knowingly spread false information. But then I question, like, some of the articles that you see in the mass media, especially these days, that, well, I guess very convenient timing for them then that particular provision was repealed. But it's all selective application. Of course, that would never go and apply to the mass media organizations unless there was some fall guy writer. Occasionally there's some fall people that they have going to fall on their own sword then for particular articles that ruffle people the wrong way. Actually, there was a writer for one of the other national newspapers here who she went on sick leave and they ended up firing her. But the particular thing is she was talking about how some shooting incident in Quebec, that it was because of their culture there, how they don't accept immigrants enough. And so, but that's a case of where they will let someone go there. But of course, they're not going to go and turn the guns in on themselves with that thing. So it's all selective application. And he ended up winning that case eventually. That was struck down. But what you have is there was some other case recently where you actually had a Supreme Court justice say that truth is no defense against if you're going and spreading hate. At least what they say, it doesn't matter if you actually tell the truth, you're still going creating a culture of hate, which might they figure, well, of course, they're saying that it's going to lead to another Holocaust is what they're implying, that it's going to lead to all sorts of violence and killing.
Right, right.
And getting just people just so whipped up into emotions that they just play into the whole slippery slope argument. And that's the thing. They're not actually talking about like a rational look at it. Like, okay, maybe there could be a case where like they do have that provision against calling for genocide. But then there's the one about just willfully promoting hatred, which is just so ambiguous. And you don't even have to prove that there's a particular victim, one who could like really go and cause a ruckus. So pretty much impossible these days. You know, the thing is, in terms of that, the mass media just so tightly controlled now that you can get like an internet following, but they have ways of going around that as well, like targeting the ISPs and saying to go and shut that down. But one positive thing, at least, which ironically the Harper government was behind, but I'll go and explain my thought on that, was that back in 2012, they went and repealed a section from the Human Rights Code where there were various people being brought up on hate charges. It was a quasi-judicial type of tribunal. It wasn't a criminal charge, but you would have to go and defend yourself. Otherwise, they could go and fine you for a bunch, and your name would be dirt. I mean, even being mentioned. But you had two prominent guys. Actually, one of them was, well, both of them are writer for the National Post that I was citing earlier, and one of them is also with the Sun News, and they got in trouble for supposedly spreading hate about Muslims. I think that was part of the decision and why that they eventually repealed it, the conservative government, because they realized that, well, these provisions were not intended to protect against people going and spreading hate about Muslims.
Yeah, so, exactly. Wasn't that Mark Stein and with Ezra Levant or something like that?
Yes.
Yeah.
Right. And so at least the good news is that those provisions were taken out of there. But then that actually led to more heavy-handedness than, which you mentioned about Arthur Topham, and then he was ultimately charged under the criminal provisions once that whole carpet was yanked out from under them to go and get him since 2007 after the human rights complaints. So you did have that thing in terms of getting rid of charges spreading false news and also with this tribunal. But like I said, that they say that truth is no defense if you're going and spreading hate.
But that's just, I mean, let's think about that for a moment. That's unbelievable. First of all, that these laws are very ambiguous, as you said. They always are, so that they can be used basically against anybody, as many as possible, or whoever they seem fit to be targeted at any given time. But the very aspect that they do not recognize truth as being an aspect to this, I mean, that's scary territory right there, considering all number of things that can occur in the fact that we cover up things, even in terms of journalists, right? What they write about a story, but then it's going to be deemed, I mean, where is this going to end? Someone is offended by something, and they can try someone under that law. I mean, it literally is going to turn us into, I don't know, robots that won't be able to express any kind of opinion anymore because it's going to be deemed offensive by someone. I mean, that doesn't work in the long run, you know?
Yeah, I had been following the Arthur Topham case, and I had interviewed him myself, and there was a very revealing thing that came out when the Ontario Civil Liberties Association courageously had supported his case and specifically calling for the repeal of those hate crime provisions. So not going and endorsing what he said, but his right to the freedom of speech, where he's not doing anything in terms of physically harming anyone.
Exactly.
But what actually came out was they sent a letter then to the attorney general of his province, who had to give the consent, or her office, for the proceeding of the charges. And there was just some form response that came back, but so revealing which what I mentioned in my interview with them, is I noticed that they actually said that the way they go about these charges is they do it, they have a strategic reasoning behind it. And so right there, that's implying that they're going after certain people. Like, one thing is Arthur Topham, they can more easily go after him than someone like Ezra Levant, who has the connections within the media. And that's the whole thing, is you don't have the connections within government if you're Arthur Topham, like they did to try to influence pulling back those provisions at the Human Rights Tribunal. But another thing is what you're referring to about the chilling effect then that they want to go and send, that all it takes is one conviction in this particular case, and that'll get so many people to not go and talk at all about Israel's crimes.
Yep.
And about the undue influence, to put it mildly, of some religious zealots within the government. Of course, this is a big thing, is that Canadians regard themselves as being fairly moderate with religion. We pretty much cast religion out of things so much, even though our constitution actually recognizes the supremacy of God. But since 1982, but on this other hand, what I see is like a really, and the Canadians see it overall too, about this really religious fundamentalist Christian Zionist mindset then amongst the leaders, and also with the foreign minister, at least he was at the time, is all John Baird then, as well as one of these really big hardcore evangelical Zionists.
Yeah, yeah. Well, if anybody missed the interview that we did with Arthur Topham, go listen to it for more on that story. We have it on our website. And then there's also an additional interview, obviously, that Jason did before that over at faux-capitalist.com that you can check out. And it's a very important case. It's a very important story, because it, as all those kinds of cases are, they might, if something occurs under that, if they set a precedent in some capacity, they could really quickly begin to nip at the edges of the political spectrum. And as you said, down that slippery slope we go, which is not beneficial to anybody. In other words, what the point here is that even the detractors of someone like Arthur should still be in support of what he is doing, for the very fact that, so that they can continue to say what they will. But it seems to be too much of an ideological battle here going on for people to recognize the danger when the state comes in and you know, try to clamp down on journalists and even your ability to free speech, you know?
Yeah, a lot of Canadians just don't feel that it will personally affect them.
Yet.
That's what we notice. But I was pleased with actually something really positive that happened in Canada. I think this may have just been last year. I think it was last calendar year. And it was where the government and the police were actually talking about, yeah, we want to register everyone's address along with their phone number and IP address. Now, you know, who's to say that they don't have some sort of registry right now with the Department of Defense somewhere, but maybe it's not a complete thing. But they wanted to have this available directly to the police. And Canadians, to their credit, and also good news about like the Sun and National Post that I was talking about, because usually they would support these kind of hardline things, of course, all in the name of fighting Islamic terrorism. But they actually came out against that, and that was stopped. But then again, this is what it comes down to, is that perhaps that was really on the agenda. They didn't like it at all, that was blocked. Actually, it turned out that was related to where the particular minister said, we need this to go after pedophiles. That's why they wanted to go and track that. But luckily, he stuck his foot in his mouth and said that if you don't support this, you support the pedophiles. So that actually helped us. But I think perhaps that wasn't really supposed to happen, that screw up. Well, obviously not. And I think they misjudged it. But this is the case where these two attacks now can go and just bulldoze that over. They may decide to go for that again. Of course, mending it slightly so that people don't realize that it was the exact same thing that they had been in an uproar against the year beforehand.
Well, Jason, let's take a break here in a little bit, and then we'll continue to talk more about Canada and obviously the founding of Canada, who built the country and how it's being transformed in front of our eyes. We do want to get into the economy portion a little bit later, too. We do have some things we want to talk about some of the World Bank whistleblowers out there, like Karen Hudes and others. You've written some good stuff on that, and I think that's still one of the more top hit article, actually, on your website. But Tell us about your website a little bit here, Jason, if there's anything new you've been up to that you want to plug and make our listeners aware of.
Right. So besides that Arthur Topham interview, which I highly recommend, especially to the Canadians listening, because it's so essential that they're going to use that as a precedent then if they would get a conviction. And it's going to be very difficult to overturn that. They could just go after a lot more people. So I advise Canadians especially to check that out and sign the petition online. But I had specifically been getting into municipal politics recently, that because there was an election that was coming up. And I think that that's really important to get involved locally, because that's how we take things back. And if you can't go and influence things at a local level, it's much more difficult to influence things at a national level, except for great organizations that are really grassroots. That's how then things actually can be influenced more at a national level than at a local level, because sometimes it's very difficult to get people involved in the local issues. But that's something I've been focusing. So my whole thing there is, with my experience of it, it was I enjoyed it very much, really, for the first time ever getting involved in the local politics of following it and going interviewing one of the local candidates for mayor, actually. And to me, I think that's really important. If we can get out there locally and you could show yourself as like someone who's really reliable, knowledgeable, and is a good overall person, that's what can go and influence other people more. And then it's going to be a lot harder for some of these detractors to come out later and try to isolate you and say you're an extremist and you're promoting hatred and whatever else just by talking about some of the issues that we've been talking about.
All right, very good. FaulxCapitalist.com is the website. Go check that out and check out some of the interviews there as well, then on the local level of politics. Stay with us, Jason. We'll take a short break and then we'll be right back.
Right, Matt, you are my conehead mate. But Belar, we share this human state. Well beyond our own dimension. Not our designed intention. Right, Matt, your cone is shimmering in the light. Belar, I'll fly the sensor. Interstellar. Oppenheimer, Edward Teller. Our home on Remulac is distant. My cone control has low resistance. Don't want to hold.
Thank you.
Homes in our own home, our homes.